Hi, I'm Sean Walsh.
And I'm Hillary Walsh. Welcome to Let's Get Rich. This is a podcast for entrepreneurs who are growing law firms so that they can live rich lives and leave rich legacies.
In each episode, we'll provide action steps to help you get unstuck, beat distraction, and find freedom.
Let's get rich.
Let's get rich.
The irony is that we're going to talk about feeling scattered and like how to beat that. And the irony is that I have self-diagnosed myself through TikTok of having ADD. And so I feel a little bit ironic in teaching this, but I know what I know, even if I do feel a little bit ADD all the time.
Well, sometimes the best person to talk about is somebody who's feeling that way.
Yeah, if I can teach people how to be focused, if I can be focused, anybody can be focused.
Well, you've built a business while feeling scattered, right? And so that's part of it, is how are we going to succeed while we're feeling scattered? And we identified this as one of the key reasons underlying our distraction, right? And why we feel stuck.
Sometimes I wish that I could have like these thought bubbles. Like, remember when we watched Scrubs and JD, he would have like these little side thoughts, and like he would come back to reality and then say something like, tiny powerful fists. And that's how I feel sometimes. So if you're like me and you feel a little bit all over the place sometimes, and perhaps have a little bit of trouble focusing on different things, and then you start to feel that horrible feeling of being scattered and kind of having that almost pressure on yourself of like, I know I need to take another step, but I don't know which step to take next. This podcast is for you, because we're going to tell you two things to do depending on where you're at revenue wise. And then honestly, I feel like the cycle just continues and you rinse and repeat, but who knows? But we're going to start if your business is under $1 million, and then the next piece is if you're from 3 to 5 million in annual revenue, and then we'll end today on if you're 5 to 10 million. Sound good?
That sounds great. And we broke it down this way. Not that other things are not important. Not that if you're under $1 million, you shouldn't have some processes, or you shouldn't be worried about, you know, keeping good books and those sorts of things. All that still matters. But these are your key focal points when you're feeling scattered, when you're not really sure what to do next. If you're in this revenue category, here is the top couple things to turn your attention to and to focus on to allow you to continue to grow and get to the next level.
Yeah, you can do a lot of things, but if you want to do one thing really well, this is what I would recommend. And of course, like any lawyer, I'm not your lawyer. I'm not your coach. This is not, I don't know you. I don't know your law firm. So I'm going to caveat everything with saying that. But if I went out and I were building another law firm today, this is what I would do. Like, this is what I would do. And I have a really recent experience of this because, you know, I started the firm in 2019. So I was recently under $1 million a year. And these are the things that I did. So shall we jump into it?
Yeah, you bet. And everything that we're going to talk about today is stuff that we've done. So this isn't like we didn't read it in a book and now we're offering it as a, here's the advice. This is our experience and getting there. So we'll jump right in with the Hillary. If you have a law firm and you're under $1 million, you're striving to get to that first $1 million in a year of revenue mark, what do you do when you're feeling scattered?
You go hustle and hustle, hustle, hustle. And this is actually the song that we listened to before the podcast, and it's one of my favorites. But you Rick Ross that shit, and you go out and hustle. So what you need to do, and you need to focus on, are sales and marketing. The more clarity you have on who you are talking to, in that, especially in that first couple of years, or maybe you've been in business for a long time, I don't care how long you've been in business, if you're building a business plan that shows you that if you acquired more clients, you could do over $1 million in revenue. You know, if you're selling like paper sleeves for your coffee cup, I think it's going to be harder to get to $1 million in revenue than if you're selling a service that's $10,000 per client. But in any event, you need to figure out, who am I selling my service to? And then all of your content and all of your sales conversations are speaking to the problem that they have. In my space and in the immigration space, I initially started out my firm being a detention center. Like I fondly...
You were the queen of La Palma.
I was the queen of La Palma. My clients called me the queen of La Palma because I was in La Palma so much.
La Palma is a detention center in Arizona.
It's not a glamorous place. It used to be a federal prison, and they changed it over into an immigration detention center. And I dressed the part once I learned that. I mean, I was dressing the part before I got the nickname, and my clients said it affectionately. They weren't being anything about it. They just called me the queen of La Palma, and I would wear all white every single time I would go. I would wear white, even though the detention centers are, you know, you're in a like a public space, you're going to get dirty and things like that. But I would wear white pants, white blouse, white shirt, because I wanted to go in there and look like kind of like royalty, if you will, or like someone's, I wanted to be like the angel, I wanted them to have really good vibes when they saw me, and wearing white in that environment really helped me feel that way. But I was hustling and marketing to detained people, and the service that I sold them was freedom. And once I figured out that I actually sell freedom to everybody, because it's the word that I need most in my life, it's the thing that I need most in my life, that helped me unlock a whole lot of other levels. And if I were starting all over in a law firm and I had no clients and I knew nobody, which is exactly how we started the firm, is I would go to the detention center and I would hustle and I would sell in a detention center, because your clients will spread the word for free for you. Your marketing costs you nothing once you get one client in a detention center.
Yeah, let me back up for 1 second for anyone who doesn't know the story. So we moved to Phoenix, Arizona in the end of 2018, and we're not from Phoenix. We don't know anybody, but we landed here and Hillary said, I'm going to open a law firm. We knew nothing about running a business, opening a law firm, any of that. She just said, I want to help people. I want to, you know, run my own firm. I don't want to work for somebody. So she sets out, she puts out her shingle, opens her law firm. It's just her. And she doesn't know anybody, right? We have no contacts in Phoenix. She has no professional contacts, no, you know, church.
I knew some people from the Florence Project, and they hooked me up with a pro bono client, and I worked for that pro bono client. So I will give that.
Okay. So, but you had taken some pro bono cases through the Florence Project when we lived overseas, but we moved to Phoenix now. And it's not like you have a network of, you know, family and church contacts and whatever else. You're starting a business really from scratch. So when you say, if you were starting again from scratch, this is what you would do. You literally started from scratch.
That's what I did. Yeah.
So. And that's what you did. And you, I watched you do it, get in the car every morning and drive an hour to the La Palma Detention Center and meet with your clients. And even when it was just one or two clients, you would still go visit them. And word of mouth spread. And that was where the nickname, it became kind of funny, but it was affectionate in that you kept coming to check on your clients. And every time you went down, they brought their friends and they brought more people. And the referrals grew and grew. And I watched you single-handedly build a $1 million law firm just on that one case type in removal defense. You got so clear on exactly who your avatar was. And even now, you've now built a much larger law firm. And you do hardly any of that type of work.
Yeah, we don't do any detain work anymore. If you're not someone who's going to do detain work, let's say that you're an immigration law firm owner and you're doing family-based cases, the same messaging is true, where you need to, your focus should not be on, I need to get my systems set up. I need to get my policies and procedures written so that when all these clients come beating down my door, I have a way to service them. I just really respectfully disagree with that approach and would never advise someone to build a bunch of systems before you're over $1 million, because you're going to blow past that. The goal is not for you to stay at $1 million. And so all of your systems are going to be obsolete by the time the next calendar year starts, ideally. So what you want to do is just get revenue in the door and with the clients who you actually want to work for. So don't start taking, and it's really hard in the beginning when you're just trying to get some money in the door, you start taking cases that are kind of like garden variety, and you'll take maybe a removal defense case here, maybe an appeal there. And then, you know, and these are for people from all over the world. So I used to take K-1 visas, and we did still do a little bit of K-1 visas, but it'd be like a K-1 visa from Scotland, and then a K-1 visa from Australia, and then a K-1 visa from Mexico, all the same case type, totally different experiences from what our clients need, their cultural needs, their cultural expectations of what a good lawyer is. And then also the consulates are totally different. And so they have the same problem. They're engaged to an American and they want to come to the United States, but the needs that they have are so different. So what I would say to someone, even if you take a garden variety of cases, try to service the same avatar client. Try to service the same human throughout the whole process. So I specialize in, I really love working with Mexicans. Undocumented Mexicans here in the U.S. are my ideal client, but undocumented Guatemalans, anyone really from Latin America. But I really have a soft spot for Mexicans because the pain of being right across an invisible border called the U.S.-Mexico border, that just really pains me. That hurts me so much on a personal level that I can, you know, that can really feel for my clients. So that is the client base that I have chosen to really specialize in. And I have all my branding has the Mexican and American flag on it because I want to signal to people that I am your attorney.
And so getting really clear on your avatar client was a huge step for you. And that then enabled your marketing to be very specific for who you were trying to reach. And rather than taking every case that walked through the door, you were able to really narrow it down to this is who I want to serve and what I want to do. And I think part of that was knowing that there were enough cases to go around, the abundance mindset that comes with that from, you know, my experience being by your side, that was a big part of it. And when you got that marketing down, then the next step from there would be sales. And something that stuck with me from one of our mentors, David Nagel, was when he talked about sales is the only way that money moves in the world. And I remember as soon as he said it, my, you know, logical engineer brain wanted to disprove it. And so I tried to think of any instance that could, wait, is that true? And it is true. It is true. The only way money moves in the world is through sales. And I think I used to view sales with a little bit, used car salesman, ick kind of a view. But tell me your insight into sales, because it is one of your strengths, clearly. And I think it is something that everyday people like myself struggle with.
So that's why I created New Frontier University. We have a whole immigration law sales training program. And it helps people with, like, if you're doing intake, if you ever graduated from HTM, all of your intake people are usually called dragons. Someone in your law firm is called a dragon if you are an HTM graduate like me. But basically people who are appointment setters and closers. You have to train both of those different teams. And we've hired, onboarded, and trained so many people that I made this whole platform for it. And then now we open it up and we help other immigration law firms because now they can access that through New Frontier University. But I love sales. You know, my background as a kid of entrepreneur parents was my mom and dad, when I was like 10 years old, started their own floor covering business. So they would sell carpet, tile, anything that, you know, you stick on the floor, rugs, laminate, vinyl, you name it. We would sell that and we would help people make a decision about, you know, what color looked good for with these different things. And my mom and I, and even my dad, don't really have a design background. My dad is a very charismatic man, and I learned sales from him. I started selling when I was 10 years old. And we started out where we were just selling the roll of carpet that we had in stock because we'd already paid for that. And so that was the best product for a lot of people's homes at the time. We really recommended it. And looking back, like it really was a classic purchase. So I'm glad that Dad got that as our first roll of carpet to sell. But here's the thing. Here's why I love sales. Sales is a heart-to-heart connection. I do not believe in high-pressure sales. I do not believe in shady sales. And I do not believe in selling someone a service that they don't really need or that would not be of high value to them. I really believe in, you know, providing 10 times the value of whatever it is that I am selling to someone. And that's why we've added so many different components to our legal services, like free therapy and stuff like that, free childcare for clients, et cetera. And when you approach sales from this perspective, because now you understand your client and you understand what the needs are that they have, and that you have the problem, you see the problem and identify it, but you have the solution to that problem, and you're going to help them through this process. It is so beautiful. It is, I mean, I cry. We call them strategy sessions, but I'll just sit and cry with people as they make that decision. And I'm so happy for them. And I can see in my mind's eye, like what it's going to be like here in a couple of years when they come back into my law firm and I hand them the green card that we were working to get. I can see that in my mind. And I'm just helping them make a decision about whether or not I am the right attorney for them, because I know this is the right process for them. And because we work with so many Mexicans, I know that my team is also the right team for them. So I have a lot of confidence in that. So if you're under $1 million a year, you really need to master sales. And if you've been really close to it and you feel like this is not, or I don't like sales, or I feel uncomfortable sales, I feel uncomfortable asking about money. These are all money mindset issues that you are going to have to fix. This goes back to kind of what we talked about in episode 2 with dealing with the law of the lid. If you are uncomfortable with sales, you have to hire someone who can help you with sales. You have to hire someone who has less discomfort around the money. And for me, that was Maria. When I first started selling legal services that were like not bond and basic removal defense cases that I was doing for $3,000 or $5,000, and I started selling $10,000 and $15,000 cases. I had a lot of problems and a lot of mental blocks, and Maria didn't have that. And so Maria was on the phone as my translator. And then once we started into price, I just asked her to explain what the price was and to go in for the sale. And that's how we tag teamed it, because I had a money hang up on asking people for money in that, in those initial years. And it was so helpful to have someone to help support me with that. But had I not known that I had this mindset issue, I would have really been in trouble, because we wouldn't have been closing.
Yeah. And as someone who grew up not with any contact with sales at all in my life until this, it was like learning a whole new world. And once I saw what you were teaching on your course and to your employees, and seeing the sales side of it, and, you know, selling with heart, one of the programs you ran, it's just, it was a game changer for me, because it made me realize that when you're being a technical expert doesn't necessarily make you the best person to sell the service to the client, because when you're selling the service to the client, you're really trying to understand what they need and how you can best help them. And if you're super technical, like I have an engineering background, and I think on some level there's similarities between that and law, and you go to sit down and talk with a lawyer, no offense to all the lawyers listening, but they tend to over-explain, right? They want to give every detail, and they want to give every caveat, and they want to, wait, let me just clarify this point here. And it's actually not what's needed in the moment.
It's so painful.
It is painful. I'm sorry, lawyers out there. You guys are great.
Honestly,
we need you.
It's painful even to talk to lawyers over dinner, because the stories are so long. And you actually told me that law school ruined my storytelling, because once I went to law school, my stories became long because I would include every freaking detail.
The best stories are 10% true, for the record.
Well, I also don't lie. But yeah, you over include details. And that sucks when you're in a sales conversation, because you're just running people off. I often call it, like, no one wants to go to the Cheesecake Factory. When you go to the Cheesecake Factory and you're hungry, it's like a 35-page front and back menu. And it's very overwhelming. And all you want to do is figure out what to eat. And then imagine the waiter or waitress walking up and telling you about all the specials of the day and giving you another 15 options. You get
And also telling you how they're made.
Also telling you all the ingredients. But you get so overwhelmed that now you can't make a decision. And a lot of times lawyers screw up the sale by going into all the details, by offering, number one, too many services. You need to let clients know, like, the pros and cons of the general, the pros and cons of why you're suggesting one service over the other. But that's because it's tied to what their goals are. But you also don't want to go into, and then this is the motion I'm going to file, and then this is the filing I'm going to send to USCIS, and it's going to be sent by FedEx, and you're going to receive a tracking number. And then, no, nobody wants to know all of that. They want to know, what's the price? Can you help me solve my problem? And then, what's the value? Like, are you going to really win for me?
All right. So we know who our client is. We got clear on that. We started direct marketing to our clients.
If you're thinking, what do I do right now? And you are under $1 million, then my suggestion for you would be, is you need to go out and let the universe know you're open for business. Maybe you've been open for business for 5 years, but Renata Castro is who gave me this advice. She told me this story when I very, very first started How to Manage, and I met her, and I found out that this woman had over $1 million. I bet she was over $2-3 million at the time. And I was like, I can't even imagine this. So I went over and chatted with her, and she's this really charismatic person anyway, ton of fun to be around. And she said that she would go with a stack of her business cards, and everywhere she went, every drive-through she went through, she was like, if I'm at the grocery store and I'm buying a bottle of wine, I tell the check person who's at the, you know, checking her out at the checkout counter, oh yeah, I got to buy this bottle of wine. I'm an immigration lawyer and my cases are super stressful. Here's a business card. If you know anybody who needs help, let them know, and please give me a call. You going to Starbucks? Thank you so much for this coffee. Yeah, I'm exhausted because I'm an immigration lawyer and I'm out fighting for immigrants' rights to be able to stay in this country. If you know anybody, here's my business card. And you're letting the universe know, this is my takeaway from Renata, is you're letting the universe know that you're open for business and this is your hustle. Don't go out and, like, work yourself to death, but the hustle is, I am energetically ready for it. I am ready for it. And then when your people, your prospects sit down to actually meet with you, don't run them off. You need to shut up and listen to what their problem is and then tell them, thank you for sharing this with me. Do you want the bad news or the good news? And they're always like, the good news or the bad news? And they're like, they want the bad news first. And then the bad news is this is going to be expensive. The good news is I can help you and you're not going to have to leave the country and you're going to be able to hug your mom again. If everything goes right, God willing, primero Dios, we're going to get this figured out. And then you've told them it's going to be expensive, but you're going to solve their problem. And then now you show them the price, and then you show them the down payment, and then they pay it and you close. But that's only going to work if you know what your client's pain point is, because then it's just bad news that it's expensive. So go out. If you've been open for 5 years, if you've been open for 2 years and you want to hit $1 million in revenue this year, you need to hustle like Renata and let everybody know you're open for business so that your focus is sales and marketing. Don't worry about people. That's not to neglect your people, but don't worry about your people plan. Don't worry about your business plan. Frankly, you don't need a business plan if you're under $1 million. You need a hustle plan and an energy plan. And then next, when you hit $1 million and it's time for you to, even if you're under two, I think that this is almost true for two, the next transition point that you're going to be in is that $3 to $5 million, where now you're going to have a new focal point.
Yeah. And so, this was very true in our business in that we were still hiring. There was still, you know, a little bit of everything still going on, but with a main focus being marketing and sales and getting a lot of clarity around who we're marketing to, and then training our sales team to effectively identify the problem, the pain points, and how we can help people and really maximize the value we're providing our clients for those sales.
The single most important move that happened for my business was in July 2020. So 1 year and 4 months, 6 months into owning this law firm. And I got a tumor and I got sick. And I was hospitalized numerous times. I'm okay. It was not cancer. It was just like a wild fluke thing. But I got sick numerous times over the next 6 months. And what that resulted in, you know, the pandemic was going on at the same time, it was a really stressful time, was people who had previously just been my translators for all of these consultations I had done, hundreds of consultations. When I was sick, they would still do the consultation. And my friend Kate, Lincoln Goldfinch, was supervising them essentially by answering their questions and making sure that they were selling the right legal services while I was sick and could not function. But this set my law firm up where now I like the limit on our law firm, the lid on the law firm's growth at that time was how many consultations can Hillary do while also managing payroll and all these other pieces, right? There's only so much you can do. But once we trained sales team members, non-attorneys to do sales, it was a game changer.
Yeah. And so then the next revenue point that you get to is that 3 to 5 million. And that's where you really start focusing on hiring the right people and bringing those people in. You've now built, you've got a sales course, you've got this stuff kind of ready to go. Now you've got to bring in the right people because, you know, we know that the thing that grows the law firm is marketing and sales, bringing in more clients, right? And then, so hiring. We got to hire the right people, and that's a huge challenge. Everybody knows it. You see it all over, whether they're saying, oh, kids don't want to work these days or whatever, you know, you're seeing on social media and people talking about. But it turns out that's not true. There's tons of great people out there. You just need to find them.
And if you believe that, if you are believing that myth, go listen to episode 2 because we bust that myth in episode 2.
Yeah, totally. So there's great people out there, and now you got to find them. And now you're moving into this, hire the right people, because that allows you to multiply yourself. Rather, like you said, you were limited by how many strategy sessions you could do in a week while still doing legal work. Well, when you bring in other people, now every person who joins your firm makes you money, right? They make money for the firm. If they're not making money for the firm,
You can't afford to have them.
And I think, at least I used to look at hiring as, oh, it's going to cost me X number of dollars to hire this person. But it's not. That person's going to make you more money. So hiring another staff member to grow your firm is actually increasing your revenue. It's not costing you anything.
Yeah, especially if they're leveraged correctly. If they're not leveraged correctly, then yeah, they're going to cost you money. Or if they're not a good culture fit. And a lot of people are like, well, I don't know who to hire next. Who do I hire first? I think that's such a common question. And I really feel that because sometimes you are like, I need to hire everybody. How do I know who to hire next? And a book that I recently read and it was so recommended to me was Buy Back Your Time by Dan Martell. And we need to have him on the podcast because he's such a cool dude. And not that I know him personally, but I'm just putting it out into the universe. Dan, you're invited. But he goes through an exercise with you in that book that really helps you figure out who to hire next. And most of the time as lawyers, we think we need to hire a lawyer next, that's like our next hire. And we really don't need to hire that person next when you go through Dan's analysis. And instead, you need to hire people who literally cannot do what you do. And so for me, that was an easy pick because I do not speak Spanish or, you know, this year I don't speak Spanish, but hopefully by the end of the year I can say that I speak Spanish. But definitely when I was in the 3 to 5 million and in the under zone, so 0 to 5 million, didn't speak Spanish. So I had to hire a lot of Spanish speakers to do client updates, to do consultation, translation, and everything else that was necessary. I couldn't translate a birth certificate, and I couldn't afford to send this off to, I used to use this translation service that I can't even remember the name of it. I think it was called rushtranslate.com. And they would put all over everything rushtranslate.com, and it made it seem like I was always doing my translations at the end of the filing, even though I wasn't. But, you know, I couldn't afford $20 a birth certificate when I started to do more and more of these cases. If I had a family of like six, that's like a lot of money just on translating this one birth certificate. So I had to hire people who I could not do what they do. I can go out and do sales. I can go out and do marketing, but I can't do some of these client updates. So those were the first people that I hired.
Yeah, and I love the concept of taking your salary, whether it is your desired salary or your current salary, either one is fine. It's an exercise, right? This is the money I want to make this year and divide it by 2080, right? Mm-hmm. That's a 40-hour work week. It's 2080 hours in a year, approximately. And so divide by 2080, that's your hourly rate. And then look at everything you did today. And in the beginning of the business, there was a lot of answering phones or calling clients for updates or things that didn't need to be you, or, you know, you weren't the right person to be doing them. So finding the things that only you could do as the owner, as the CEO, as the lead attorney, you know, as you're growing in that phase, you're still wearing a lot of these different hats. And so figuring out your hourly rate and then deciding, what do I want to do for this rate? And so, you know, whatever your personal rate is, take like 10 seconds right now to do that.
Oh yeah. Let's go through this exercise, okay? Because this exercise is going to help you understand not only how to create your pricing. So in the legal space, we all know that you're not really allowed to share what you price things at, because they in the legal space, we want to prevent basically price fixing and like having a monopoly essentially on what prices are. So it's discouraged to talk about what different people charge for different things in public forums. But everyone's answer is always just take how many hours it's going to take you to do the work and then multiply it times your hourly rate. And that's what you should charge for something. But then you're like, well, how do I determine my hourly rate? I determine my hourly rate by guessing. I talked to a gentleman here in town, and he told me that he charged $500 an hour for his services. And I was like, cool, me too. That's what I charge for my services too. I had no idea like what that meant or what that was tied to. But when you think about how do I bill for associates, you multiply times three. And that's how you can determine what your rate is going to be for that service. So let's say that your associate is making, for easy math, $100,000. So you need to bill your associate out at $100,000 divided by 2080. If you want to just do 2,000 because, you know, they're going to take PTO and whatever, that's easy too. And that gets you to roughly $50 an hour. So let's use $50 an hour, multiply that times three. Everything they should be doing should be billed. If you're doing flat rate like us, we don't bill per hour. But you're going to build all of your pricing on every hour that the associate is anticipated to spend on this service. I got to bill at $150 an hour because I have to pay the associate. I have to pay her $50 an hour. I have to pay $50 towards marketing because all, you know, I got to have a piece of this to market my business. And then I need $50 to cover all of the other overhead that it takes to run my business, like the building, like we pay for Filevine, we pay for the phone. All of this has to go into that. I got to pay for malpractice coverage for me and for this associate. So if you multiply it that way, you're always going to make money when you create your pricing, your flat rate, because you've multiplied it at least times three. I would even suggest by four, but three would be the bare minimum, because you want to have a quarter of that if you do multiply it times four for profit, so that you can actually stash away some profit in each of your cases.
Yeah, and as the CEO or CFO, I would advocate for times four.
Times four.
Because times three will cover your bills, and that is good.
That's as low as you can go.
But yeah, you want to be profitable.
That's pay in full rate, baby.
Why open a business if you don't ever plan to make profit?
Totally. And then when you look at your own hourly rate, like as the owner of the business, well, you can look at if you don't want to get aspirational, what did you pay yourself last year? Let's say you paid yourself $200,000 last year.
It's about $100 an hour.
That's $100 an hour.
So anything you're doing that is not valued at $100 an hour, you're making outbound phone calls to leads or even to clients to tell them, hey, there's no update this month. If there's someone else that you could possibly hire who could do it for less than $100 an hour, and there is, you should hire that person.
You should hire that person because they're going to make you money. So this is really going to, like, I know that when it's time to hire and you're like, how am I going to pay for this? It just somehow magically works because now you're doing, and really it's not even $100. It's $400 an hour.
Yeah.
Because we're doing times four, right? So you need 100 that of your hour to go to profit, 100 to go to marketing, 100 to go to et cetera, et cetera. And what you have to pay yourself. So it's 400. What can I get done for less than $400 an hour? And you start to realize I need to get on Upwork. I need to get on 99 Designs. I need to look at outsourcing some of my receptionist stuff. Like we use, I think Lex Reception is the outsourced when we have overflow. And then we've got to hire people because paying people and like really investing in them, you can get a lot of help at less than $400 an hour.
Yeah. And I will caveat too. We're talking about when you're at 3 to 5 million, when you were in that under 3 million phase, you did every job, you wore every hat. So you know what you need.
I was the janitor.
Yeah. Right. So we're not suggesting you open your business and immediately outsource everything because by doing it yourself, you fully understand everything you need in your business and you build your own best practices by doing it yourself. And those are going to become your processes that you will really start to solidify as you approach that $5 million mark. I can remember an example of you working an entire weekend on a system, on a policy and procedure for a certain thing. And then about 2 weeks later, you came to me and you were kind of upset because you're like, it's already obsolete. Like it's been a couple of weeks. We've already grown in the last few weeks and I've already changed. And so I spent an entire weekend on this policy and procedure and it's basically throw it away. You know, what do I do? And so there's kind of it's not that you don't need policies and procedures as you grow. It's just, they're going to be changing and it's going to be constantly evolving. So as you get to that 5 million, you've been hiring people. There's also something to the practice of hiring people. Once you get good at it, you get used to it, you start to feel for what you need and who you're going to hire, it becomes easier to do, almost like muscle memory. But you get to that $5 million to the $10 million mark, and now you really need processes. And so the best analogy that I like, and I don't remember where I heard it first, but I've heard it more than once now, and that is anyone can make a better hamburger than McDonald's, but nobody can make a billion hamburgers identically, right? And so that's the key to processes, right?
Yeah, I love it. And I've spent a lot of time over the years interviewing, and I love interviewing people. But you, as you get into that 3 to 5 million, you'll need to train other people how to do that initial interview. So this is the first year we've had a full-time recruiter in our law firm, and that's been outstanding because we do a ton of what's called a culture screen. We screen for culture first and skill or knowledge second. If you don't get past the culture screen, then I don't care how amazing you are, you're not going to be a good fit in our company. So we screen for culture first, and we actually have a 3-part system, you know, with a Canva download available and all this other stuff. Someday I'm going to make it available. I haven't made it available yet because then you can just take it, plug it in, and it's got the training that you need at each stage, but eventually we'll get there so that people can access that. But that really helped free me up so that I wasn't feeling the pressure of needing to decide exactly who to hire every single time. So now there are certain positions in the firm, and of course we're in the 5 to 10 million zone. So I'm just giving you if you're in the 0 to 5 million zone and you're like, I am so tired of interviewing people. And I'm pretty introverted, so it takes a lot out of me to sit down for interviews and really stay plugged in with people. But anyway, just know that you will eventually get to a place where all of those hiring decisions, you have now cloned your culture and what your needs are, because you set up a system that really identifies what those are, and those really tie into core values and those guiding your hiring decisions. But you'll eventually get there. And now I have people who are onboarded in the firm, and like I'm in a Teams meeting with them, and like our all firm team meeting, and there will be people I don't know who they are. I don't know what they do in our firm. I'm so delighted that they're here and I can't wait to get to know them. But that was a really cool shift to not because I'm like the great and powerful Oz, but just that it was like, oh, I've cloned myself enough to where now we're onboarding great people. And I wasn't the one who had to do it. So you will eventually get there. So let's talk 5 to 10 million.
Well, and that's a process that you built, right? Yeah. In order to hire a recruiter, had you brought a recruiter on full time when you were at a million, I don't even know if you would have had the full fleshed out process of these are our core values and this is how I screen people for culture fit. And having interviewed, you probably interviewed like 1,000 people. I mean, maybe more. But doing it so many times over the years as you built your business allowed you to build a process that you could then teach to the recruiter and say, this is who we're looking to hire. And it wasn't an overnight thing, right? It was a build out of that process. And as you built these processes, it was great because as you formalized them, that became the foundation for New Frontier University, which you mentioned at the sales training at the 1 million mark. But you didn't have that training when you were at a million. It was just you. And then your first handful of salespeople were literally working next to you. And then eventually they learned enough to just do it on their own. But it wasn't until you were the 5 to 10 million that you actually formalized it into a training platform. And this is how I want all of my future employees to learn. And this is how I want them to do this job.
Yeah, because at the 3 to 5 million point, we started hiring in batches. So I would hire and we would have one class a month and we would hire 15 to 25 people every month. We did that for several months in a row. And then we would kind of go through a calming season because we still were not, and I don't think anyone's ever going to be perfect at hiring, but less accurate. We were still not very accurate. And so that's why we were hiring kind of in bulk. Because we didn't have a system for training. So we would have to stop all operations. One person would have to stop all operations. If they're new appointment setters or dragons, everything would stop so that we could hire, onboard, and train this one person. And then if that one person didn't work out, oh my gosh, we got to go back to the drawing board and individually train that person all over again. And so I was like, well, I want to have 10 great dragons. So I'm going to hire 25. And in the next 60 to 90 days, we will have figured out, it's kind of like boot camp. So look to the right. I'm guessing what boot camp is like. Do they actually say this? Where it's like, look to your right, look to your left. One of you won't be here tomorrow.
No, that's just in Hollywood.
That's just in the movies. Okay. Well, I believed it. And that was like New Frontier boot camp. It's not that way as much anymore. Now we hire a lot more accurately and we also portray ourselves a lot more accurately as well. I really try to tell people all the bad things, and I would rather oversell the bad aspects of working here than the good aspects. But in any event, you will get to a place where you're bulk hiring. And I really recommend if you're going to hire one paralegal, hire two, because if both of them work out, it will work out. You will make payroll. You will figure it out because they're going to get so much work out that then you got to go back into the sales and like get more cases going. But the likelihood that both of those paralegals work out for more than a year is statistically low because paralegals have a pretty high turnover in any firm. I don't know why that is, but every firm I've ever talked to, and definitely in my firm, that has been the case. So hiring two paralegals at a time just became something that we always do. We never hire just one paralegal. And then similarly, we never hire just one salesperson. We hire multiple salespeople because you also will then be able to see KPI versus KPI. Is this person just not hitting the KPI because maybe our KPI isn't good and our expectations aren't good? Maybe our training sucks right now? Or is it, you know, now I have kind of another benchmark where this other new hire at the same time started with the same training, they're killing it, they're understanding it. And so now I know it's not necessarily our training and it's not necessarily the KPIs, it might be this other person. And that helps you as well to really have clarity on what steps need to happen next.
Yeah. And the training program for, you know, anywhere, whether it's like the joining the military or joining a company, you need to onboard and train a person. You can't have them walk in the door and just expect them to know. You know, people with experience will know more than others. But the time that it takes them to get up to speed is the only part of their employment that really does cost you money because they're on payroll now, but they're not yet producing for you. But it also costs money because somebody in your firm has to train that person. But when we take one person out of the game for a minute to help train these new people, it doesn't matter if they're training one person or two people or 10 people. The cost is the same. So if we train 10 new employees at once, what it costs us to take someone out of the game and train 10 spread across 10 people is much lower cost per acquisition of our new employees. So training in batches has been really helpful for that,
yeah.
Right? training one person versus training five or training 10. And what we've found is that when you hire a group of people, is if you end up with multiple people who are rock stars and they're amazing, it grows your firm. It's not like you don't end up with this impossible decision of how do I split the baby. You literally end up with two superstars and you're like, well, this is awesome. You go to this department, you go to this department, and let's grow because now we've got more capacity. And that is true for sales. That is true for legal work. That is true all around the firm for the people we've hired, is that we don't hire rock stars because we don't find out they're rock stars until later. We hope to. But I would say of all of our hires, I don't know, if I had to ballpark, I would say 20% have stayed with the firm, but the people who stayed are incredible.
I don't know the math either, but in any event, I think that when your whole firm has to stop and one person is training, it's kind of like a photocopy. I think that's the real pain point as well from when you're doing all the hiring. Because like not only are you trying to make the right decisions and you're trying to grow the firm and then your payroll is going up, so that means your marketing spend has to go up. And it's just, you know, you feel like you are always riding the bicycle up a very steep hill. But as soon as you get through that people stuff, like truly, once you're on the other side of it, and that's one of the things that New Frontier really, like the university really freed me up from, was now I knew that if I had to let somebody go, not that I ever wanted to, but if I had to let somebody go, I no longer lost the energy of the team member who had been pouring into that person. And you also don't know with consistency, like we have a rock star paralegal who's been with the firm since 2020, and I just adore her, and I hope that she's a lawyer in the firm someday. She's an undergrad right now, and I'm her champion. You know that. Yeah. I'm her champion. But she has trained so many people in our firm, and she's outstanding. The reality was, though, I had no way of knowing with consistency if she had trained them on every single aspect that I was holding them accountable to our standard on. And that really was unfair to her because I didn't have a training system that she needed to follow. And it was also, from a management perspective of those team members, unfair to them because I was never showing them what the standard was, and yet I was holding them to that. And again, that's why I made New Frontier University. I made it for my law firm, so I didn't have this between a rock and a hard place of really asking myself, did I set this person up for success? Have I shown them what they need to do? Have I given them feedback and accountability and everything else that's necessary, and they still haven't met it? Or am I expecting something of them that is unfair, and therefore we're always going to be in this like hiring and firing loop? I really wanted to feel high integrity with those decisions. And the only way to do that was to be uniform. And the only way to do that without having an actual trainer on staff was to create the training myself. And so that's what New Frontier University is for legal assistance as well.
Yeah. Before you had the training, we were still doing training. We had other platforms, right? We had people going out to other platforms and taking sales training or taking different types of training. But we found that there was a specific legal sales training and specific immigration legal sales.
Legal assistance too.
And legal assistance. And so by developing our own over time, which isn't something you do when you're at 800,000 trying to break a million, it is something you do when you've brought the people and the processes in place, and now you develop that training in that 5 to 10 million. So kind of to recap the whole thing, right? We talked about a bunch of stuff, but the focus today was if you are feeling scattered, right? And whether it's distraction, whether it is just not knowing what the right next step is, you're feeling stuck where you're currently at, trying to get to the next level, we're trying to give the focal points that we did to grow the firm that worked for us, right?
Yeah. If you're under a million, it's hustle. Like, and hustle from an energetic perspective where you're just letting the universe know, letting everybody know who you're interacting with, that you're open for business and this is the client that you're looking for. And that person's going to come to you. From the 3 to 5 million, it's hiring. It's your people. It's, you know, really trying to get those folks in place and trained up to standard, because now you're going to go into basically scale mode. And then from that 5 to 10 million point for us was absolutely setting up processes. And we're still in the process zone, but it was also implementing, it was deflattening. It was like inflating is what I want to say, our organizational chart. So we went from being a flat organization to you have to install leaders. And that's a whole process in itself, because hiring leaders and getting those people in place, it can be very challenging, But the only way to find the right fit is to try your best. And so if you're kind of at a point where you're like, I know I need to hire this person, but if it doesn't go right, because like it hasn't for these past couple of hires, again, there's probably some mindset issue in there, some internal issue that's going on with you that you have to get really honest with yourself on. But then the other part is like, you don't know until you try. Stop beating yourself up for past mistakes. Stop beating yourself up for hiring failures that you've made in the past. Those failures taught you something. And so they are always a net positive. Now, pick yourself up, move forward, and keep your business going. We hope that this has helped you feel unstuck, a little less scattered, a little more focused. And if you would like to hear more, tune in for next time.
And if there's anything we said today that resonates with you, we'd love to hear from you. We're trying to answer questions in future podcasts. So, hit us in the comments or on social media and let us know what questions you have, what resonated with you, what you'd love to hear more about, or where you're feeling stuck. Thanks for joining us.
Bye, friends.